You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 147 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
We're going to begin this podcast with a couple of toasts, so I feel like we should get right into this week's beer.
Well, first, though, one thing.
Oh.
If you haven't already.
Oh!
Listen to the return of Talkin' Taco Time after a three-month hiatus.
Whoa!
It was precisely 3 months since our last episode of Talkin' Taco Time. This was a great one. Eric Randall of Taco Cat joined us. The aptly named Taco Cat. We learned about the Juanito. We talked a lot about menu updates. A lot of news that has happened over that span. But also coming in a crisp 40 minutes. So a pretty easy listen.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, can I tell you some Taco Time news?
Okay.
At Taco Time Corporate, which I drive past on my way to work every day, they have like a sort of like caged off like dumpster kind of area. And they have an old school Coke machine, not the new ones, but the ones where you hit the button. And it's like branded like old school Taco Time logo on the outside. How aggressively should I be trying to break in there and steal that?
I feel like that would compromise our relationship with Taco Time.
I wonder if I just asked if I was like, can I, like, if even if the thing doesn't work, I still want it.
It isn't quite a decoration, yes. Okay.
Anyway, so if you haven't listened to that, I would say drop everything right now. Stop listening to this podcast. Go and listen to Talkin' Taco Time. Also, if you're not following the Pelton Cast on Instagram, what even are you doing?
That is a great question because you're missing out on a lot of ramen, which we will discuss later in this pod, and B, a fair number of Lil Woody's Burger of the Month posts.
There we go.
Or Burger Month posts, I should say.
All right. So what is it that we have here with us to drink today?
We have the Reuben's Bits and Bobs IPA, which, going with that, I picked up at Beer Star when I was there to go to Lil Woody's.
Oh, interesting. Can you tell us about Bits and Bobs from our good friends at Reuben's Brews?
I can do that. Each year, we will brew a slightly different Bits and Bobs, highlighting the hops and malts that make us most excited over the past year. This year's Bits was brewed with some of our new favorite hops, Grungist. This strangely named hop from Germany, which actually seems quite appropriate for Seattle, doesn't just make us think of one of Seattle's indigenous musical genres, though that did inspire us to brew Grunge Crush last year. It evokes flavors of peach and passion fruit, along with lemon zest, and florals. Helping the Grungist along are significant amounts of Citra and Comet. All of these hops are bolstered by a malt bill, which is a word I've never heard before, of pale, golden promise, caramel, and oats. So there you go.
You, my friend, sound like LA 80s hair metal. You had a hard time with grunge there. All right. Well, before we get into this, a couple of toasts that we have to make here.
We do. First off, a toast to Jeff Sullivan, formerly of Lookout Landing, and most recently with Fangraphs, on joining the Tampa Bay Rays front office.
There we go.
Follows in the footsteps of fellow Seattle baseball writer Dave Cameron, who's now working for the San Diego Padres. And do you know what the best part of this news is for Jeff Sullivan?
What is that?
He doesn't have to watch the Mariners this year.
There we go. Well, a toast to Jeff Sullivan for not having to pay attention to the Mariners.
And for getting a job in baseball, that too. We're also pouring one out, kind of a sad note, Monday, for the Seattle Weekly, which will publish its last print edition on Wednesday after more than 40 years as an alt-weekly in Seattle.
I'll tell you why they're closing.
Why is that?
Not enough searches for Seattle's best ramen.
That is probably true.
Brackets for the various foods or reviews of Pelton Cast Live.
Mm.
I crunched the numbers. Zero. Not even a preview.
That is fair, but the Seattle Weekly, once upon its time, did some it continued to do good work, but did really terrific work as a print in a print format back in the day, including friend of the pod Damon Agnos as part of the staff there.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, they go the way of the grungest.
Pour one out. All right, this is a big week in our search for Seattle's best ramen as we complete the final four, the semifinals. So I feel like we should get right into it with our third Pelton brother. For this week's ramen bracket, the last spot in the final four. We are long overdue to have as third Pelton brother, one of our foremost, longest running fans, someone who sent us Rainier tall boys, Jubilee can tall boys from a previous year so that we could drink them on the pod. And we remain so appreciative of that. So again, it is overdue that we had Tyler Gardner on the pod as a third Pelton brother.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Tyler, you're like football in Los Angeles. You're like basketball in Seattle. We flirted with you for a long time. Finally, third Pelton brother on the pod.
And it feels good. It feels right to me.
We can tell from the level of excitement in your voice.
I'm ready, man. I'm up late. I'm just drinking beer. I'm home with my dog who's staring at me like I need to be paying attention to her. It's great. It's just real good stuff in here. Good atmosphere, I think.
I do that with children while I'm podcasting. Tyler, as we always do, please tell us your ramen credentials.
I was kicking this around today, and I think my biggest ramen credential is just eating along with this bracket, mostly.
That's a good place to start.
I think it's pretty good. I really, for me, or I guess for a lot of people, I think people stop eating ramen at some point when it gets over like 60 degrees. And I just don't feel that way at all. I just eat ramen year round. I think I've got a lot of ramen under my belt, but I don't know if there's anything that stands out that dramatically in terms of my credentials.
Well, what about making the top ramen recipe that we shared on this podcast from Third Pelton Brother Reese?
I was going to come back around to that, but that is my crowning achievement as a chef. that's it.
Okay, so you were kind enough to join us in waiting for Saturday brunch at Tsukishinbo on Saturday morning.
Which, by the way, if we could specify, I think we've talked about this brunch being on Friday, right?
Yeah, so previously it was Friday lunch. That's how we were kind of appraised of it, is when Tsukishinbo, which is normally primarily a sushi restaurant, serves ramen, Tokyo-style ramen. And last fall, they made the switch. They got rid of their lunch. They're only serving dinner during the week, but then they have this weekend brunch. And strictly on Saturdays, they serve their ramen. So we were told that people wait in line for like up to 45 minutes. That turns out it appears to have only been on the Friday, maybe not on the Saturday brunch. And, you know, maybe it was because of the fact that it was like 38 degrees outside. But I got there at 10:20 and there was no one else there. Until Tyler showed up about 10 minutes later. And the two of us waited for about 5 minutes before realizing it was futile and going to wait in his car until a couple of other people finally showed up, maybe around 10:40. And by the time it opened at 11, when lunch service starts, there were probably six groups, I think, in line at that point.
There was a bit of a line. I was guessing there were about like 11 people.
Probably more than that, but like six parties, because it was not quite enough to fill up the restaurant at that point.
It was at 10:30 when I showed up. It was a pretty sad sight, Kevin. It wasn't a line. It was just one guy standing outside a ramen restaurant.
You need multiple people.
ESPN's Kevin Pelton standing outside of a ramen restaurant.
And so one of the reasons to line up is because we didn't deduce how many this actually is, but they have a limited number of bowls of ramen that they serve. But fortunately, we were obviously all able to get their Tokyo style ramen. So reading up a little bit on Tokyo style, it's soy sauce based. So similar to the shoyu ramen, but I don't think quite exactly the same. There's a little bit of their spin on it. I don't know if this is the case at Tsukishinbo specifically, but apparently traditionally chicken as opposed to pork broth.
Interesting.
So,
And so that comes in, basically you're getting like a little meal when you get it. It's a little bit more expensive. I think it's $15.
Yeah.
And you get the Japanese style ramen plus a bowl of rice plus four pieces of basically gyoza. They call them dumplings, but basically four gyoza. Tyler, thoughts on this ramen?
I really liked it. I also really liked that it came out as kind of a combo. I think the gyoza was a nice addition and something you don't get at most places. And I really liked the little bowl of rice too, because I put it in my broth at the end, and it was nice. It was really solid. Overall, I've graded all these out. Do you guys want me to go in order, or can I give you some general thoughts first?
Whatever you want to do.
Sorry, I'm gonna do ratings first because I don't want to bury the lead. Classic journalism. I think this is the best broth I've ever had.
Wow.
I gave it a 10 out of 10, and what I'm typically looking for is just kind of like a nice texture that's not too thin, I think is where I gripe a lot. And if I'm going to nitpick a little bit about Arashi, which look out, Tristan, I've got some hot takes for you off air.
Oh, God. No, bring those takes on air.
Yeah, the listener wants them.
Weekly.
I really like Arashi. That's my home ramen. I go a lot in Ballard. And I think in general, it's kind of like B+, A-, it's right there. But I do complain sometimes because I think their broth is too thick. It's like really, I don't know, some of it's just like too nutty or something. It's very strange. Huh. But I think that Tsukushimbo nailed it. Like, it was so good. It was so rich in flavor. It was not thin, but it was also not like eating peanut butter with noodles in it. So I really appreciate what they did with the broth of this, and I give it 10 out of 10.
Wow, okay.
It's a powerhouse broth that they have there at Tsukushimbo.
I only gave it an 8 out of 10 because of the fact that there is no spice to it. There is no creaminess like
but
you get...
there's flavor.
In the tonkatsu, the classic tonkatsu ramen. But yeah, I mean, it's incredibly flavorful. Like, it's as good as you can do without having either of those things to me.
Yeah, and I went back and forth between 9 and 10 asking the question about whether spice would diminish what it is as it sits.
Right. It would be a strange fit.
Yeah, I think it, yeah, I just don't think it would work as well. And I think it was, yeah, they nailed it, in my opinion. But 8 also seems okay, I suppose. The other thing that I think they did really well was their pork. And I also gave that 10 out of 10. It was the best pork I've had in a ramen because I nitpick a little bit on that too, in that I don't like the pork when it's super thick. And it feels like it's hard to get all in the soup spoon with noodles and scallions and all that stuff because it's taking up too much space and is hard to it gets like hard to get apart from the other bits of pork sometimes if it's too thick.
Yeah.
And they have like a nice like thin little kind of like a patty versus like a slab, and I thought that was incredible. That was, I don't think I've seen it quite like that before.
I didn't give that a 10, but I gave it my second highest score after Arashi, which was 7 out of 10. I agree with the general tone, if not quite the score.
You're very particular about your pork. I thought the pork also was very good there. I'm gonna rate the other restaurant that we were at the best pork that I've had, though. We'll get to that in a second.
Interesting.
Interesting. Okay. And then I think there are only 3 elements in the Peltonkast grading rubric for ramen, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I gave the noodles a 9 out of 10, which I think I may have been a little generous. Maybe they were an 8, but I also kind of think ramen noodles are hard to mess up. If they're like too hard, I get kind of mad. But if they're too soft, like that's fine. But I thought they were firm enough, kind of hearty, but not stiff, not like certainly not al dente. So I gave those 9, and I thought those were really well done too.
Wow. So if this was the dunk contest, right? This is a 49 out of 50 that you gave it, filling in the other categories, which definitely would have been 10s.
Okay.
This is a 29 out of 30 that you gave it. This is Vince Carter putting his whole arm in the hoop right now, right?
Well, that got a 50.
This is me just taking an 8 and turning it sideways to infinity.
Yes. Wow.
All right. I also gave the noodles 9 out of 10. So we're on the same page on that one.
Man, noodles were excellent. I want to... Okay, let's... It's pretty clear what we felt about Tsukushimbo. But I'm curious everybody else's thoughts on Aloha Ramen in Lake City. We had to make a bit of a trek, a little bit longer for us than it was for you, Tyler. What did you think about Aloha Ramen?
I thought Aloha Ramen was good, not great, basically.
What'd you get there?
I got the Aloha Ramen, which is roasted garlic sesame miso. In the vein of trying to order what they want me to order. And I know that's not like their specialty, I think, but it is the thing, it's their namesake. So I thought that was a good decision. And I didn't love it. It seemed very, it wasn't very flashy. It seemed workmanlike. It was like, it was a ramen, you know? And that's,
I mean, it'd be weird if it wasn't.
Wait, did you get that same thing?
No.
Okay, but it's with the, you got also got something that's with a peanut based sauce, right?
Yes, I got the Tan Tan, which
I believe the Aloha is also.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. The Tan Tan described as a Japanese Chinese hybrid made with sesame paste and chili oil, as well as an Aloha's version peanut, was. Aloha, we should, I also have this down in the notes with that. Aloha was chosen the 14th best ramen in the U.S. by Time Out in 2016. I am not sure what Time Out is, but they sure like Aloha Ramen, which is kind of the OG of the Seattle ramen scene. Previously was in, I believe, Greenwood, some other location, and then moved at some point to Lake City, and then also changed ownership at some point from the original owners, I believe, were from Hawaii, which makes sense that there's kind of a Hawaiian influence to the menu and then the name, of course.
On the peanut-based ramen, can you taste the peanut in the broth?
No. So I don't know if you want to get into my review of this.
But wait, Tyler said that you can, right?
Well, no, that was one of my questions because the one I got is like is sesame-based, and my notes are just like super sesame and also pretty peppery. So they kind of like went all in on the sesame thing, and I was going to ask KP if that was the same case with the peanut.
No, I mean, I would say that it was maybe my favorite broth yet. I rated it 9 out of 10. You know, I want to leave room for that 10 out of 10. I don't want to get, you know, the highest score in the dunk contest and then have to give everyone a 50 like the actual dunk contest this year. But I would say what I thought was notable about the broth here was that it really reminded me of the coconut soups I like in Northern Thai and Burmese cooking. The khao soi, of course, and the similar Burmese dish, which I cannot pronounce.
That definitely makes sense, though. I thought the broth was very good there.
Now, what did you go with?
I got the spicy garlic miso. So it wasn't a peanut-based broth, but so I'm assuming the owner or whatever is taking the order, right? And he was like, "You can get the pork that we have." He's like, "Or," and points to the board. He's like, "There's pork belly for $3.50 extra." Did he ask you two about this?
No.
And I was like, "Give me the damn pork belly, of course."
Huh.
Like, you also went on Sunday, right, Tyler?
Yeah, I was there right around lunch.
Because to me, that pork belly, it was thick. I'm just going, I'm blowing past. I thought the broth was good, but this pork belly, it was thick, but it was so flavorful. It was the kind of thing where it's just like, I would just take slices off it and eat it straight as it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, any time that somebody says you can have pork belly instead, the answer is always yes.
That's a good stance. That's the
no matter
stance.
What's after the instead.
I mean, it does make it kind of expensive at that point, but yes.
It doesn't. How many times am I going to be at Aloha Ramen in Lake City?
Well, potentially up to three, although we'll see how the rest of this conversation goes. It might just be one.
I don't like its odds. It's interesting because I think both of them were so close without necessarily doing the rating system. It's like if Tsukishinbo is a near perfect score ramen, Aloha Ramen is so close to it, right? Where it was like, I thought that the pork was maybe a little bit better than Tsukishinbo. I thought the broth was slightly worse, and I thought the noodles were, they were good noodles. But there's something about having the broth be a little bit better that maybe moves it past the pork belly.
I mean, as I've described, you know, one of the things that I've found over the course of this bracket is that definitely the broth is the driving factor.
That's why it was a 49 in the dunk contest. Because broth actually is 30 points.
All right. Do we want to keep going through the – did you give us your score for the broth, Tyler?
I gave it a 7. I don't know if I gave it to you already, but I gave it a 7.
And then how about the noodles?
Noodles, I gave an 8. They seem fine. They fit perfectly well in their ramen. I got to go back and try these things that you guys tried. I think I may have misstepped a little bit in ordering the Aloha Ramen.
Well, Mrs. Fantasy Genius got Kahlua pork ramen,
which I was intrigued by.
Sounds great.
And she was very satisfied with it. And the owner was like, "That's my invention. There's a lot of Kahlua pork in there. Let me tell you."
Oh, maybe the new owners are Hawaiian. Maybe I've got the order of this wrong.
There was a lot of Kahlua pork in there. And it was good. I tried some.
Okay. Well, if we go back, it would probably be what I would try. But again, we'll see about that. I give the noodles 7 out of 10. They're relatively thick. Thought they were good, but not great, sort of along the same lines as Tristan. And then the chashu, not having the pork belly, I gave a 6 out of 10. Two huge cuts of pork in the one that I got, and very tender, but I would say unexceptional in terms of flavor.
Yeah. Okay.
Did you give us your rating for the pork chashu?
I gave it a 7. My notes are unspectacular, and that's it.
Wow.
Yeah.
You needed the man to point to the board for the pork belly.
Yeah, nobody pointed at the
board. This is where you got the treatment. Like, I didn't get that. I needed that.
You're going to want to go, like, 10 minutes before it closes.
Is that the move? Is that how you get the guy?
Yeah. You got the pork belly? Nobody else in the restaurant.
Nice.
The people at the Papa Murphy's nearby closing up shop. You had also mentioned to us when we were having ramen on Saturday, just mentioning kind of ramens like the Kalua pork, which are outside of kind of the normal basis, that up by the Chucks in Greenwood, they own a ramen shop. Is that right?
Yeah. So Chucks owns a place called Barbecue Smith on 80th and Roosevelt on the other side of I-5 that does something they call cowboy ramen in the winter. That's ramen with brisket. As far as I can tell, I don't know if there are other changes, but those two things sound like they'll go together just as well as ramen and Kalua pig, if you ask me.
Oh my God, I have to try this.
Yeah, that sounds quite fascinating.
Yeah, you beware. Loyal listener Nate and I, also loyal listener Lexi and I, went 2 Sundays ago, and they were out of meat. I walked in the door at a barbecue restaurant and asked for the ramen, and they said, like, oh yeah, we don't have any meat.
All right, here's the photo of this. This is from a week
ago.
People
can't see that.
Sunday.
Just you and me can see the photo.
We'll post the photo on the post note here. Cowboy Ramen has arrived, serving hot bowls of our brisket rich or pulled pork loaded ramen for the rest of the day. And it has corn, so Tristan, I know, is out on that. But otherwise,
I'm out on the corn?
Well, didn't you say express last week that you were out on corn?
I don't mind the corn.
I feel like your opinions are malleable from week
what
to week.
What are those things, by the way?
I believe those are mushrooms in that particular bowl of ramen. But
we sure looked at a picture that nobody else could see.
We'll be having spirit specials nearly every week, so expect to see this one return in the near future. I guess you got to check out the Barbecue Smith Instagram to be appraised of when it may be on the menu.
Whew. All right.
I don't think it matters that you guys are just looking at a photo right now. I know that Kevin's going to cut this whole part featuring me, so it just is irrelevant. I have two little asides. One, I gave like a half bonus point, if there is such a thing, to Tsukushimbo for having a fish cake in their ramen, which Aloha didn't in mine, and Rashi doesn't do. I thought that was a nice touch.
That's in the Barbecue Smith one here. Yeah, I think this is the first ramen that we've had in this bracket that has had that.
Yeah, that's a nice touch. Aesthetically, very pleasing.
It definitely dresses up the photo. Okay, second aside.
Second aside is that in the course of last week, I went in order to a Rashi, I think on Tuesday, made the third Pelton Brother Reese special ramen at home. The next day, then went to Arashi again, then went to Tsukushimbo, then went to Aloha. And that was a lot of sodium.
You might want to lay off the ramen for a little bit.
Or do, but drink a lot of water.
Okay, well, given that you had that much ramen last week, tell us, Tyler, who is your pick in the 4-5 matchup of the PeltonCast search for Seattle's best ramen?
My pick is Tsukushimbo for this part of the bracket and forever will reside in my heart.
And forever. If you had to rank every one of those ramens that you had, how would you rank them?
Obviously, the homemade Reese ramen, then Tsukushimbo, then Arashi, then Aloha.
Wow. Okay.
Interesting.
I mean, the choice to me, I don't want to say that the choice is easy because it wasn't. Like, this is a competitive matchup. This is the 4-5. I really liked Aloha Ramen. I would go back there if I was ever anywhere near Lake City ever again. To me, like, if this was your home ramen,
we're going to have to go up there at some point to go to Tubbs Subs as part of our search for Seattle's best sandwich.
Wait, there's subs there?
Yeah.
I'm always so excited for the next search that we're doing.
Yeah, yes.
I think if Aloha was your home ramen, you wouldn't need to travel to any other ramen place. It was excellent ramen. I enjoyed the experience thoroughly. Thought it was great. It's just, it was going up against what I would consider maybe at this point, depending on what happens, a real challenger to the one seed in the next round in the Final Four. And the pick has to be Tsukishinbo.
So as we were leaving on Saturday morning, I told you, I've got some things to think about. Which you then, when you came back on Sunday night from Aloha, agreed that you had some things to think about, even though it doesn't seem like it was as difficult a decision for you.
Oh, no, they weren't Robin related.
Oh.
I have such things to think about.
Your 10 to 15 children, for example, whether I had successfully taken care of them while you guys were out at dinner. I, because of the fact that I like the broth at Aloha Ramen so much, I graded these two both a 90 overall. But then as I was thinking about kind of making a decision here, I was weighing the fact that I liked the style at Aloha a lot, but I liked the execution at Tsukishinbo a lot. And to me, execution trumps style, because if you don't also like that same style of ramen that I like, then you may not have the same experience at Aloha that I did, or if you order a different ramen. But I think anyone who goes to Tsukishinbo, unless they're just completely opposed to Tokyo-style ramen, is going to enjoy it because the craftsmanship is so high.
Well said.
There's something to me that I really like, though, about at Tsukishinbo, and I want to talk to you about Arashi for a second here, Tyler, that there's only one bowl. Like, there's no customization. There's no, oh, if this is your preference, if this is your preference or whatever. It's, this is the Tokyo-style ramen, and you're going to like it,
yeah.
Right? Like, nobody leaves from there feeling like, I didn't get the right thing. You know what I mean? Like, to me, having one thing that you do and doing it well, I think it's excellent. And doing it one day of the week and only having 50 bowls of it, I think it's an excellent place to be. Which brings me to my question to you, Tyler. When you go to Arashi, do you get the Arashi ramen?
No. No, I don't need that much pork chashu. That's not for me. I usually get the spicy miso tonkatsu or the spicy tonton men.
These are all things that Tristan could have gotten. I was reviewing my text messages.
Here's the thing. When Tyler said that he went to Aloha Ramen, what did he get?
He got the Aloha.
He got the Aloha Ramen.
But you didn't get the Aloha Ramen.
Item, if your signature item doesn't taste good, if you
have
a bland, flavorless signature item, you can't be that good of a ramen place.
Look, I'm looking forward to Katie coming on and telling you how wrong you are.
You can't. This is what I said to Katie after. It was like, you couldn't have eaten that bowl of ramen that we had at Tsukishinbo and tell me that you continue to defend Arashi.
What do you, just because Arashi isn't the best ramen in Seattle doesn't mean it's good ramen. The same as you said about Aloha. Like, if that's your local ramen shop, you can enjoy it and not have to wait in line at Tsukishinbo, hypothetically.
Yeah. I mean, you can get Arashi any day of the week. It's
crazy. But I think there's, or multiple days of the week.
Yeah.
But
I think,
I think the other thing you're missing here is there's a big difference between the experience of going to a ramen shop one time as part of a competition, not knowing anything going in. Then, yes, the single option, that's great. But if you're going to it every other week because of the fact that it is your local ramen shop, like Arashi or Aloha could be, then you're going to either, you're going to figure out what you want, or you're going to want that variety to order a different thing every time so you can mix it up.
Would you tell Loretta's to make something besides a tavern burger?
Loretta's does make a lot of things besides a tavern burger.
But they don't make other burgers. They'll make you
a
veggie tavern
burger. Actually, they do technically. Sometimes they'll do specials, which are other burgers.
Nobody orders those.
They wouldn't do it as a special if no one ordered it. That would make no sense.
The spicy tauntaun man, I'm very, very curious about, though. It's like, I'm willing to admit there probably are things that I would prefer at Arashi. It's just the straight Arashi ramen, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't think that's the best idea even. Like, it's just normal ramen. They just added more pork. Like, that's cool, but is that really your namesake ramen? You can do better, I think.
But I think it makes sense because we've rated all eight of these now. I gave it the highest score in terms of chashu, so I think it makes sense that they should be kind of emphasizing that. It's what they do best.
Yeah, I guess if that's where they want to hang their hat, that's fine. That's not my favorite thing, so I just kind of avoid it and wouldn't order that. But the spicy ones they do are really good. I think, Tristan, you touched on a really good point that the lack of customization is, I think, could be kind of divisive if people want to view it a certain way. But I like that Tsukishinbo just comes in and says, like, here's your ramen. We tried to do this very well, and hopefully you like it. But that's it. We're like Danbo, it's all customization beforehand. And then I think Betsu Tenjin was all after the fact. They gave you the like tray of sauces and peppers and powders and all kinds of stuff that you can play with, which is really fun as well. But I think the energy Tsukishinbo brings to say, like, I hope you love this fucking ramen is pretty cool. Also, you can cut that.
Well, it's going to make for an interesting contrast next week, because our first semifinal in the search for Seattle's best ramen will pit the top seed Danbo against Tsukishinbo. Oh, then our other semifinal, we went straight chalk, as it turned out, in the top four seeds, despite some controversy along the way. The other semifinal will match number two seed Oink against Tokyo Ya Ramen in Federal Way, and we'll do that in 2 weeks. But for now, Tyler, thanks so much for joining us and helping us make this choice.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I hope the drive to Federal Way is really nice, and I hope that you're hydrating well through the rest of this.
Will do.
See you guys.
Whew, all right. That was a good one. Thank you again to Tyler for joining us. That was excellent. Next week, we are going to be doing the number one versus number four matchup. That is Ramen Danbo versus, you just heard us talking about it, it got a near perfect score from Tyler, Tsukishinbo. We'll be joined by the famous cousin Katie to talk about it.
Her long-awaited return as judge.
Oh, the opinions are going to be hot.
I like the idea that if you go next Saturday, we know the famous cousin Katie will be there, that all of a sudden there'll be tons of Pelton Cast listeners there, and there actually will be a really long line.
We won't even get a bowl of ramen. That's going to be no holds barred with Katie. On the other side of the bracket, we have the 2-3 matchup between, as you mentioned, Oink and Tokyo Ya Ramen and Federal Way, which we'll be getting to in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I said all that already. Good summer.
Look, for people who are eating along, they need to hear this a lot.
That is true.
Especially if they're not following the Peltoncast Instagram. They're not seeing these updates.
It's unclear to me if anyone is actually eating along. I guess Tyler said that he was.
There we go.
Speaking, we mentioned a bit ago, Lil Woody's Burger Month, Seattle Burger Month. This is the final week now of Lil Woody's Seattle Burger Month. What did you think? We both had the deli burger from Chef Mitch Myers last week. What did you think of that?
It was pretty good. The real star was, the real star was the pastrami.
Don't tell the Russian dressing in short, though.
Well, Russian dressing and pastrami, I mean, like, God.
That's an unbeatable duo.
No better combo. Name a more iconic duo.
The everything bun was better than I expected. I was a little worried about how that was going to go.
The only thing that I was out on was just like, get the burger patty out of there. Like, it doesn't need to be there. The pastrami, like, we were talking about this offline, it was a thick piece of pastrami. I was imagining it sliced deli style, but instead it was basically like brisket, right?
Yep. I was grabbing pieces off of that and eating them individually, which they were also good in that format.
That sounds
well.
Really good. I ate the burger while I was driving. Chances of me spilling Russian dressing on myself, over 100%. Mm. Did not spill any Russian dressing on myself.
Wow.
Yeah. Well done. It was a Lil Woody's Burger Month miracle.
Because there was a healthy amount of Russian dressing on there, or also an unhealthy amount. So the final week of Seattle Burger Month features Chef Melissa Miranda from Bar Del Corso, and as well as her Musang pop-up dinners. And she is serving the Serap sandwich, roasted pulled pork adobo, chicharrones, radishes, fried garlic, petite salsa verde on a Hawaiian bun.
Oh, man.
Serap means delicious in the language native.
The Hawaiian bun really brings that together for me.
It does.
When I heard Hawaiian bun, I was like, all right, fine, you got me.
You weren't in them before that?
I was in, but I'm all the way in now.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to checking that out. I think I'm going to have that tomorrow, so look for that on the Peltoncast Instagram. Anything else on food? Let's get into sports. We'll start with a brief note that kind of touches on the NBA to Seattle, and that's Sekou Smith of NBA.com had an interview with Clippers owner and, of course, Seattle resident Steve Ballmer. Hat tip to the famous cousin Katie for sending this to us. The most interesting quote in there, I thought, he was talking about the new arena that they're planning to build in Inglewood, which is still the subject of a significant amount of legal wrangling with Oakview Group, of all people. opposing it because of the fact that the Forum, where they host concerts, is right nearby. And there's a complicated lawsuit going on where the LA Times having some great reporting on that. And it doesn't always sound great for the Clippers' chances, but we'll see what happens.
I mean, well, let's talk about that in a second.
Okay. It's about the ability to get it right, said Ballmer, referring to the arena plans. We're not putting hockey in the building. I don't think most people know just how big a difference it can make to not have hockey. You get everybody closer to the floor. The sight lines are a lot better.
So is this shots fired?
No, I don't think this is anything specific. I think
you don't think this was an intentional quote?
No. I don't think that Steve Ballmer is that worried about the situation
in
Seattle.
He's in the midst of a lawsuit with this exact company.
He is.
Who are obsessed with hockey.
He also does continue to own part of the land in Seattle, where the Soto Arena would be proposed.
He's one of the owners of part of that land?
He still has an investment in the land, yes.
Alongside Chris Hansen, or?
Yes.
Let me just say he's not following the situation. Like, just saying that this wasn't an accident by Steve Ballmer.
Look, I think he's probably comparing it to Staples Center, which is the alternative in where his team is currently playing.
Yes.
So he's saying that this can be better than the Staples Center in terms of a fan experience standpoint.
There we go. So if you're telling me that things aren't looking good for the Clippers...
I mean, we'll see how that plays out, but... The LA Times had a piece, I believe it was over the weekend or late last week, where some internal documents revealed that the Clippers and the city of Inglewood, and specifically the mayor, had been discussing this project much earlier than they had indicated publicly that they had been discussing it. And the lawsuit from the oil providers of the Forum, the Oakview Group, they had to, the land where they're trying to build this was parking lots for the Forum. They were able to now create, they're going to have parking at the Rams Stadium, which is right across the street from the Forum. But they gave up this parking land on the idea that it was going to be an office park. There was going to be businesses there, not that it was going to be a competing arena right next door.
Interesting.
So...
Is there any chance that they could have fought off a competitor in LA, but gotten themselves a competitor in Seattle?
I think that Steve Ballmer is focused on building this arena in Inglewood, if he can. If that falls through because of this lawsuit, then we'll see what happens then.
And they don't have any sort of like restrictive lease there, right? I mean, Steve Ballmer can do what he wants with that team.
Not necessarily whatever he wants, but obviously it's not the same situation because the Clippers are a third tenant in the Staples Center. I believe their lease runs through 2024, and that's when they'd be trying to open up this new arena.
2024?
Yes.
Obviously ties to the area, obviously ties to this other ownership group. Clearly something in this statement here. I mean, to me, the biggest factor is that when Steve Ballmer bought the Clippers 6 years ago, 5 years ago,
let's see here. I think that would be 5 years ago, yeah.
When he bought the Clippers at that time, $2 billion was a lot of money for an NBA team. Actually, now, $2 billion is not necessarily a lot of money for an NBA team.
No.
Like, the idea that he was paying $2 billion to own a team in LA made sense at the time. But now, a team in Seattle is still worth $2 billion.
Yes. But that doesn't necessarily mean the team in Seattle is worth as much as its team in LA. And then there's also the, you know, free agency recruiting aspect. The Clippers are going to be out there as a major player in free agency. I think the...
Who have the Clippers ever signed? Name a single free agent that the Clippers have ever signed.
The biggest free agent they've signed is probably Baron Davis. But I think that the expectation is that they are the front runners to sign Kawhi Leonard at this point, that they are more likely to sign Kawhi Leonard than any other team is, including the Toronto Raptors.
Interesting.
And I don't think that would be the case if the Clippers played in Seattle. So
they signed Kawhi and then moved to Seattle immediately after.
I like the idea of them pitching Kevin Durant on a move to Seattle.
That would be pretty nice too.
The response I got to that is that Durant would rather play in LA.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
For the Clippers?
That he would rather play in LA.
Okay. You're saying that like you know things?
No, I mean, like everyone else, I think he's probably going to sign with the Knicks if he leaves the Warriors. But that's what I was told, is L.A. would be preferable to him, which is where he now makes his offseason home rather than Seattle.
All right, fine. It's almost nice that there isn't the opportunity, because we could just tell ourselves.
Yeah, disappointed. Yeah, exactly. The Mariners are having spring training games, Gal. I don't know if you saw that. No hot takes this week, but I did want to highlight this. Yusei Kikuchi, making his first Mariners start in spring training on Monday, pitched two innings against the Reds, and most notably, badly fooled Joey Votto on a strikeout.
There we go.
So he's got the most fascinating delivery. You're going to have to look at this clip, which I have linked on the post here. But it is a bizarre delivery, and it's going to cause hitters, I think, some trouble at times this season. And that's enough baseball talk. We move on to the Sounders, who wrapped up their preseason last week with a 2-0 loss to Nacional of Uruguay in their lone home preseason match, one you attended. You have any thoughts from that?
It was a preseason soccer match.
They played a mixture of starters and mostly reserves, I would say, in that one. Then drew 2-2 against San Jose.
If I can have one thought, I think that Nuhu, we had talked about him drawing interest from European clubs, and I think that his play overall, just like confidence being reined in, what he's doing, I think that it has evolved so much in the last two seasons, and it could really tell, paying attention to him, why I think that there is interest from European clubs.
That's interesting, given that at this point he doesn't figure to be the starter at left back, that Brad Smith will probably hold down that position for the most part.
Both of these things make sense to me, where you can see, like, with the potential that he's like grown so exponentially from 2 years ago, it was a bit of a mess,
yes,
right? And that he's grown so much in that time period. But at the same time, Brad Smith being more of the like solid rock player, not necessarily going to be making as many as exciting plays, going to be moving forward as much.
And of course, Smith does have English experience. That's why he's on loan to the Sounders. So
I can see how both of these things make sense at the same time.
Okay. The Sounders then drew 2-2 on Saturday at San Jose, with their starters playing 60 minutes in that match a week ahead of their MLS regular season opener. Victor Rodriguez scored both goals for the Sounders, the first being set up by a throwback Jordan Morris run up the right side. It was great to see that pace from Jordan Morris as he comes back from last year's ACL injury. San Jose equalized with a pair of Chris Wondolowski PKs. Right back Kelvin Leerdam was sent off for his challenge that led to the first PK, meaning the Sounders finished the match with 10 players.
And that doesn't affect regular season play?
I don't know how that works. I'm actually unclear about that. He may be suspended for this week, where the Sounders will be hosting FC Cincinnati. It's the second consecutive season that an MLS expansion franchise opens up in Seattle against the Sounders. Last year, LAFC got the win in their inaugural match in Seattle. FC Cincinnati moving up from USL is an expansion franchise where they played 3 years in USL and set records for attendance. They'll be playing this season at University of Cincinnati's football stadium, with a soccer stadium, soccer-specific stadium, I should say, currently under construction and set to open in 2021. FC Cincinnati acquired longtime Sounders nemesis Fernando Adi from rival Portland, is their first designated player last July, midway through the MLS season. He finished the year playing in the USL on loan to the USL version of FC Cincinnati. Their other designated player is 22-year-old Costa Rican midfielder Alan Cruz. Some familiar names on the roster include defenders Greg Garza, a veteran of the USMNT, and Kendall Waston, a longtime Vancouver Whitecap. Another longtime Whitecap and former Timber, Darren Maddox, joins alongside Adi in the attack at forward. And then in the midfield, they have Victor Aloja, who played for FC Dallas for many years. Probably not a surprise that they have some Vancouver ties. Their manager, Alan Cook, who's also making the transition from coaching in the USL with the team. Before that, his previous job was coaching the Whitecaps second division team that played in the USL.
And who doesn't recognize all of those household names?
I knew all of those names except for the Costa Rican designated player.
Well, good for you.
I guess I follow MLS much more closely than you. A couple other things, thoughts on the Sounders as we lead up to the start of the season. They introduced a new Nightfall secondary kits designed with an accent color of purplish pink design to match a Seattle sunset.
Yeah.
going with the primary black color on those.
I have to look this up. It was all the talk of the game.
Was it?
Yeah.
They didn't unveil
it. People were very excited about it.
They didn't unveil it until today. So people were just speculating about what it might be.
Well, they knew what it would look like.
They knew that it was not going to be white, that it was going to be black this year.
And they knew it was going to be a sunset.
Okay, that was out there. I don't know that you can necessarily tell that it looks like a sunset, but there's a cool photo of the sunset on that story.
From the descriptions of people at the game, it was much more majestic than this actual thing. I also learned that Zulily is the new kit sponsor. We must have talked about that at some point.
We definitely talked about it on the podcast.
I'm like, where's that Xbox 360 that I've come to love and expect to see there with its blocky lettering?
This video is quite something.
You really cannot tell that this is a sunset, but
I mean, it's a fine looking color, but yeah, I don't know if it specifically says sunset to me.
I was like, okay, so T-Mobile is their sponsor.
Go check out the photo though of the sunset. It's a lovely photo of it over CenturyLink Field.
Hey, look at that.
The sky is gorgeous. We're having a lot of descriptions of photos on this podcast for some reason. That's what we're just going to do now.
So the other thing was beautiful. Rest assured.
This is the 10th anniversary season for the Sounders, whose opening match was March 19th, 2009, against New York Red Bulls, back when the MLS season started a full, like, several weeks later than it does now.
It is crazy. I mean, March 19th, so that was during first round of the NCAA tournament.
Yes, the Huskies had beaten Mississippi State and Jarvis Venardo earlier in the day.
And we both attended this match, right?
We did.
Along with Chris, who's been a 10-year season ticket holder. Talking Taco Time host Chris Smith. And
I must have been sitting with someone else. I wasn't with you guys, was I?
Yeah, I think me and him were sitting together and you were elsewhere.
I'm pretty sure I was like by the supporters section. I was in the end zone.
But having that match and Freddie Montero being such an instant star,
scoring two goals in the opener and then assisting the other goal by Brad Evans in a 3-0 Sounders win.
Like, you could feel the energy that day, that if I would have told you then that the team would have made the playoffs every single season they were a professional franchise, like, I'm not saying you would have expected it, but it was very clear that this was a moment, right? That the Sounders all of a sudden in that game, which may be kind of like FC Cincinnati maybe also, maybe without the same kind of infrastructure, but clearly a fan base, that they were going to be one of the signature franchises of the MLS immediately.
I mean, they set the tone for what an expansion franchise would be in the MLS. And all these other teams that have come through afterwards, the other two Northwest teams, LAFC, you know, I mean, there's a lot of expansion franchises, but those, you know, you think of as the really successful ones right away and on the pitch, they've all followed kind of the same blueprint. And, you know, maybe some of those teams can't spend as much money as the Sounders did, bringing in Freddie Ljungberg at that point as the marquee designated player and getting, you know, quality young talent like Montero and Osvaldo Alonso, who was in the USL at that point. But, I mean, the one thing that stands out to me looking back on the 2009 season, I used to do kind of podcasts that were maybe a spiritual forerunner of the Pelton cast on Seattle Sports with my friends Todd Divas and Seth Colin on Todd's website.
Without me?
Yeah, without you. Wow. And we used to like always discuss, so is, you know, are the Sounders like going to be a flash in the pan in terms of this attendance, or are they going to actually be able to sustain it? And I was pretty skeptical.
Wow. If I would have been there, I would have known perfectly.
I mean, it's usually like expansion franchises in year two, the attendance drops significantly. And instead, the Sounders just like kept building their attendance.
I don't know about still, but at least kept it stable. The attendance.
Yeah, I mean,
they've reached the point that they could sell out the entire stadium every match, but
who knows if they'll ever get to that point. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, a football stadium.
But it doesn't feel like an empty football stadium like a lot of the original MLS, you know, stadiums did, which is why they started moving to this soccer specific model. And the Sounders just haven't needed to do that. I mean, it's still probably, I mean, it's an unparalleled success as an expansion franchise, both on and off the field, everything they've accomplished in the last 10 years.
Well, there were certain teams that came about. I remember when, I think it was the same year, NYCFC and Orlando SC joined the league, and they both...
Oh, we didn't mention Atlanta in terms of successful expansion franchises, who has now surpassed a lot of the Sounders' attendance records, also play in a football stadium, and won the MLS Cup in their second year of existence. So yeah, we are the second or third. So we probably got to throw Atlanta in there.
But the Sounders are the spiritual forerunner to teams like that. And they're not necessarily what I would consider like the spiritual forerunner to teams like the Orlando and the NYCFC, who are going out and signing players, I think, strictly for attendance purposes.
Yeah.
They knew that they didn't have the fan base there, right?
I mean, Orlando has done quite well in terms of attendance, but it is a different model.
Yes. But a place like Atlanta, where it's like there is sort of like a natural like fan base waiting to go to these matches, and the Sounders were able to build kind of that way. Freddie Ljungberg was not an exceptionally known player, right? He was not like a World Cup
known,
star,
yeah,
like
he was
Kaká
known,
or
like,
something.
If you followed the EPL, you know, he was playing at Arsenal. Like he was, but I didn't know Freddie Ljungberg was at that point. I
but
didn't
like
pay
those
much
teams were signing players
EPL.
That had been huge, huge international stage.
Yeah, there was Kaká
and Pirlo.
Well, Pirlo was a little later, but David Villa was there right away. Yeah. I think. And then also Steven Gerrard was supposed to be on that team? And is that right?
Did that just never happen?
I don't think it ever happened. Not sure.
But what the Sounders built was the model for a successful expansion franchise after them. And it started that day, and it was so clear what was happening.
Yes.
To I'm the Kevin Durant coming back to the Sonics of this podcast that you're talking about. Everything that I would have said on that podcast turned out to be right.
Okay. Wait, who was the player who Man City signed but then ended up, or NYC signed but he ended up playing for Man City? I'm down this rabbit hole.
There's somebody out there screaming into the abyss about this.
Really? There's probably multiple people who are. Multiple the listener.
Shouts to you, Mike Pate.
Frank Lampard. That's who it was.
The other thing to me is looking at that roster, and granted, the names have changed quite a bit, but how many players from that team were long-term Sounders?
Yeah, I mean, usually you think about an expansion team, it's like these are placeholders. And it's obviously different in MLS because you can go out and sign designated players and you can go out and sign young players. It's not like in the NBA or MLB or NFL where you're limited to the players that are already on other teams' rosters. The whole world is out there playing soccer. But yeah, I mean, Brad Evans was on the roster for 9 years, I believe. Alonso for a decade. This will be the first season the Sounders have played without Osvaldo Alonso. I mean, Ziggy Schmidt, also the RIP, who was the manager for 7.5 seasons, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there are players, even like, I guess Keller is the closest that you had to like a marketable star, but all of it totally made sense bringing him over.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And somebody who's like the first real face of the franchise, I think.
Yeah, and was a perfect fit for that role and not someone who was going to like take away from anything else the team was doing, and you know, remains involved with the franchise now as color analyst, so you know, he's a big part of it. Steve Zakuani is still part of the franchise as a broadcaster. James Riley came back is working as a broadcaster. I mean, there's a lot of guys who are still involved and in the mix that were part of that team.
It's very cool what the Sounders have built in the last 10 years. Also, I want to point out we're incredibly old.
Because that's
10 years. Good God!
You raise an excellent point. The world.
How could that have been 10 years ago?
I don't know.
It does not feel like it was that long ago.
The other thing we didn't mention, by the way, is the timing of the Sounders starting like not long after the Sonics moved, and kind of, I don't want to say filling that void because nothing will ever fill that void until the Sonics return.
Wow.
But
Help us, Steve.
It was like the lowest moment in Seattle sports 2008. The Huskies went 0-12. The Cougars were terrible. The Mariners were bad. That's still true. The Seahawks were at the end of the Mike Holmgren run. It was like the perfect time for a franchise to come in and be successful, and the Sounders took full advantage.
They did kind of... There was definitely a space for a franchise to come over and take over a lot of fans,
yep.
Right? I mean, you still look at kind of the Sounders fan, and I think it's a unique person. I don't think you can pinpoint the Sounders fan and be like, oh, the Sounders fan is also a Seahawks fan, or the Sounders fan is also a Mariners fan, or also was a Sonics fan, right? Like, the average person that I think of who's a fan of this team, like, the Sounders fan is a unique person that I think would have been there irrelevant of all that other stuff. Right, like I think there were people,
but
that
you can't build as big a fan base as they have if it's just soccer fans, if it's just the tech employees who like soccer and craft beer.
They've managed to pick
what
off.
What a terrible combination.
Those are Timbers fans. First of all, how dare you? Sounders fans are nothing like that.
Of course.
They like slightly different craft beer.
What is that narcissism of small differences?
They don't work in tech. They work in the arts with a focus in tech. It is true that they were able to pick off kind of the other parts of it. I mean, you look at people like Chris, who is not a soccer fan before then. I feel like at least I'm like a 2006 generation soccer fan, right?
But only international soccer. You weren't following any club soccer before the Sounders existed, were you?
Not really, no.
No, me neither. I mean, and...
And now I follow it so closely.
I mean, well, I think one of the fascinating things about MLS, and this is probably more similar to baseball than NFL and NBA, is that people are fans of their club, but they're not necessarily as much fans of the league as a whole.
The, like, Sunday night MLS or whatever on ESPN, still a rough watch for me.
I think the Sunday night MLS on ESPN is fabulous.
Not about who's broadcasting it. There are many fine soccer matches that ESPN is broadcasting. Please tune in. But I'm just saying, in general, like, the quality of play, because there are so many soccer matches that are available, like, on a Saturday morning and basically the entire fall through spring, you can turn on a Saturday morning on ESPN. You can see very
ESPN high Plus. Check out Italian soccer.
High-level Italian soccer, right? You can watch basically every Juventus match. You can watch tons of EPL matches. You can watch high-level German matches, right? Like, there's so much high-level soccer that's available where even still, like, you can cheer for your home team in the Sounders, but, like, if you're just turning on the whatever LAFC versus Columbus Crew match or something, like, it's apparent that you're watching a lower level of soccer.
Yes.
And I think that's why. Like, if, because people who are fans of the EPL or BPL, is that what they call it now?
I think you'd still go BPL.
Either. People who are fans of the EPL are fans of the entire EPL and will watch basically any team, right? You have your preferred team, but you'll watch basically any team. And I don't think the MLS has quite gotten there. At the same time, I think the quality of play seems to be getting better every year.
Oh, yeah. I think so, for sure.
So that could change. That could be something that in another 10 years, when we're 100, that could be something that we look at very differently from this particular era.
The grumpy old Pelton cast. Yeah. We're recording at that point. So the season as a whole, we haven't really talked a lot about. I mean, you know, what's fascinating is the Sounders are basically bringing back the same roster. They lost Osvaldo Alonso.
We say this every year.
No, I don't think we necessarily say that they're bringing back the same roster.
The roster evolves throughout the season.
It does. But this is a more complete roster. It's basically the same roster that led this incredible second half surge.
We say that every year, too.
No, sometimes it changes. I mean, there were more changes last offseason.
We're going to go back and listen to the early January episodes where we start talking about the following season.
There were more changes last offseason. The one addition being Jordan Morris coming back from the ACL. He'll shift into, you know, a right wing spot. That moves Christian Roldan back to defensive
say
midfield to replace
two.
Osvaldo okay. Alonso. Do not say that every year. The question, of course, is whether the Sounders can get off to a better start than they've had the last three seasons. That we do say every year.
I just feel like, just run it back. Jordan Morris was hurt last year. He'll be back this year. Definitely
Jordan
not
Morris hasn't been hurt before last year. What are you
he
talking
wasn't?
About?
That was the first time he was hurt?
Yeah.
Wasn't Jordan Morris
hurt? He had like a hamstring injury or something. Mm-hmm. It was Clint Dempsey you're thinking of that was coming back. Remember Clint Dempsey? You old enough to remember Clint Dempsey?
Well old enough.
So we'll see if the Sounders can get off to a better start and give themselves a chance to, you know, a chance at the Supporters Shield this year. And, you know, that will make things slightly different than the past 3 years.
We'll continue monitoring this as their percentage chances of making the playoffs dwindle until they're basically out by the 4th of July. And then they have an amazing signing that happens and everything turns around.
But here's the thing. First off, I don't know if the amazing signing is happening this year. We'll see. I bet against it. But the Mariners' playoff odds can't be... If they're oscillating with the Sounders and they're always adding up to 100%, the Mariners' playoff odds seem likely to be pretty low this year.
You never know. Maybe the Mariners will start hot.
That's a hot take. All right, moving on.
Japanese pitcher is going to be amazing.
Moving on. I would propose another toast, but you're out of beer, to Noel Quinn, who announced her retirement from the WNBA last week after 12 years.
Sounds the same on a podcast.
That she capped with is part of last year's 2018 Storm Championship team. She'll immediately join the Storm coaching staff, replacing Crystal Robinson, who earlier in the week was announced as part of former Storm head coach Brian Agor's staff in Dallas. Quinn played parts of 5 seasons over 2 stints with the Storm and had been coaching her alma mater, Bishop Montgomery High School in Torrance, California. So she was getting her feet wet as a head coach while continuing to play and now moving full-time into coaching. So she'll be the one player who doesn't return from the 2018 team, leaving room on the roster, presumably for whoever the Storm take in the first round this year. Speaking of assistant coaches, the Seahawks making official some staff changes last week. They announced the hiring, long rumored, of Ivan Lewis as their head strength and conditioning coach. He had held the same role at UW under Steve Sarkisian before following Sark to USC, where he had previously coached under Carroll. Also notably added former backup quarterback Austin Davis as an offensive assistant to the coaching staff.
There we go.
So I'll continue to be part of the shoddy tree. The NFL last week announced compensatory picks. The Seahawks got none.
Which we knew was happening, right?
We did. But it's so ridiculous because they had a bunch of high-priced free agents that were canceled out by much lower-paid free agents that they signed, which is just terrible. It's terrible both. Like, great system you got there, NFL.
Yeah,
like,
the system's horrible.
Why isn't Roger Goodell taking any heat for this? But second off, if you are going to have this
Have much bigger fish to fry than the compensatory pick system.
That's what I'm saying, though. We're taking our eye off the ball and flaming Roger Goodell for that. But also, if you're going to have this terrible compensatory pick system, at least use it to your advantage, like, you know, the Patriots.
This is, I have to say, as a team that values draft picks like the Seahawks do, it is an embarrassment that they squander compensatory picks in this way.
Yeah.
Like, there's just no logic for it. Who are the free agents that they signed this offseason?
Ed Dixon, Jerron Brown, Shamar Stephen.
Hey, all Jerron Brown does is catch touchdowns.
That is actually.
Shamar Stephen, who they released at some point during the season? Yes. Great.
No, Tom Johnson was the one that they released during the season. Shamar Stephen.
But Tom Johnson was probably better than Shamar Stephen and ended up getting signed and then released, but he wasn't worth a compensatory pick. You can sign players that are not attached to compensatory picks, right?
Yeah, or trade for players. It's a logic in trading low draft picks for players. I'm not talking about trading second and third round picks for players.
And so now the Seahawks are left with 4 draft picks in the 2018 draft. Granted, we all know they're going to make more than 4 selections in this draft.
Yes.
But this is a roster that still needs young talent, and going into it with 4 picks is not a good place to be in. And one of the places that they could have added more picks was by maybe not signing Shamar Stephen last offseason.
Yes.
Like, none of these things needed to happen.
Yeah. The Seahawks have the lowest draft pick value in the league, as pointed out by Ben B. On Twitter. Their 4 picks, 121, 384, 4124, and 5159. So this all happens before the NFL Draft Combine starts tomorrow or today as you're listening to this. If you're listening to this when it comes out, there will be 9 Huskies who are invited to the Combine. Jake Browning, Ben Burr-Kirvin, Greg Gaines, Miles Gaskin, Caleb McGarry, Jordan Miller, Byron Murphy, Taylor Rapp, and Drew Sample. So it'll be a lot of Husky ties in Indianapolis.
Yeah, many of those players, I think, are going to be drafted.
There will be more Huskies drafted. I think there's a real shot of more Huskies drafted than Seahawks draft picks.
Wow.
We'll see how much they trade down, but there's a real shot at that.
They're going to trade for a lot of picks. Wait.
I mean, Jake isn't getting drafted.
I think there will be 7 Huskies drafted.
That seems reasonable.
BBK, 6 or 7. Greg Gaines, Miles Gaskin, Caleb McGarry, Murphy, Rapp, Sample.
Also in football news, longtime Seahawks quarterback and former assistant coach Jim Zorn was named the head coach and GM of Seattle's XFL team, which I feel like...
I didn't even know there was a Seattle XFL team.
There's a Seattle XFL team.
I got the notification, the ESPN notification on my phone today, and it was like, longtime Seahawks head coach Jim Zorn. I was like, oh no. I was like, too young, Jim. But then it was like, named head coach of the Seattle's XFL team. And I was like, okay, that's good for him.
I got to give the Seattle's XFL team kudos because they're getting a lot of media coverage. I don't know that how like fired up fans are about this team that does not begin play until 2020. All right, Husky Sports softball. UW softball went 4-0 in the second weekend of the Puerto Vallarta College Classic and head now to the Mary Nutter Classic for doubleheaders all 3 days this weekend, including matchups with ranked opponents Kentucky and Texas Tech. Another toast in order. UW women's basketball snapping a 10-game losing streak by beating Colorado 60-46 on Sunday behind 17 points from Myloney Henson and leading scorer Amber Malgoza. The Huskies, who are still 2-13 in Pac-12 play, will wrap up conference regular season action this weekend, hosting the Bay Area schools. Cal has had kind of a relatively disappointing conference season in the low middle of the pack. And then Stanford moved to 13-3 in conference play after sweeping the Arizona schools last weekend. Still in the hunt probably for a 2 or 3 seed in the NCAA tournament for the Cardinal under longtime standout coach Tara Vanderveer. We wrap up a real toast in order to UW men's basketball, which clinched a share of the Pac-12 championship by sweeping Utah and Colorado at home last weekend to run their record to 13-1 in Pac-12 play. This is just the fifth conference championship for the Huskies since 1953. So they won it twice under Marv Harshman, 1984 and 1985, both of which were ties, and then twice outright under Lorenzo Romar in 2009 and 2012. I mean, even though this doesn't guarantee the Huskies a spot in the NCAA tournament, and it's not, because of that, it's not the goal, it's still something we should acknowledge and celebrate given how infrequently it happens.
Yeah, I think we're, I don't want to say we're spoiled because it's not like it's happened that often. It's happened, I was not born when it happened in 1985, I'm guessing.
No, you were not born until well after the NCAA basketball season, but way to know when you were born.
So, wait to know. They snuck two in right there in between our births.
They did.
So
it was a good 3-year run for me.
As a millennial, it's only happened twice during my life, but you as a Gen Xer, it's happened four times during your life. Gen Y at best.
I graduated high school after the year 2000. That's what defines millennials.
Oh, just barely.
I don't want to be a millennial. I'm just saying, if you do the definition of it, I am.
It's something that's only happened twice in my lifetime. They've only made the NCAA tournament.
Well, now three times.
Oh, well, now three times, yes.
Yes.
They've only made the NCAA tournament one time in my lifetime when they've won the Pac-12.
That is accurate.
And that's part of the reason where it's like, this is great, but this is, like, just, I'm sorry, but winning the Pac-12, if you're not, we've won the Pac-12 tournament
usually
more times.
Usually, when you win the Pac-12 regular season, you're guaranteed a spot in the NCAA tournament.
It's a new Pac-12.
It's just when the Huskies win it that you're not guaranteed. I mean, I think those have got to be, that's got to be the only time in Pac-12 history that the regular season champion didn't make the NCAA tournament and was eligible. Like, that can't have happened before.
Ugh, God. But it's nice to have happened. Like, look, this is great. Winning the Pac-12 is great. Clinching a share of the Pac-12 is great. This is not the goal.
It is. It is not. A sweep next weekend at the Bay Area schools would match the most conference wins ever for the Huskies, who went 15-1 in 1952-53 when they reached the Final Four behind star Bob Hubregs, and also went 15-3 in 1983-84, the first of those back-to-back conference champions under Marv Harshman. And
would also guarantee that Mike Hopkins, in a Pac-12 season, won more games than Lorenzo Romar did at any point during his career.
That is true.
Which, I mean, you look at right now, and I'm going to knock on wood when I say this, is almost certain to happen.
It is very likely. But the Huskies also, they finally, we've been waiting for this for a long time
on the
podcast.
Mission accomplished. Ranked, this is the mission.
Ranked number 25 in the AP poll. They snuck in. It is the first time the Huskies, who were ranked in the preseason top 25 at number 25, have been ranked in the season since December 29th, 2014. During the brief shining moment that was the Robert Upshaw era.
We had such high hopes for a second there.
We got some pushback on this about me tweeting about it and saying finally on Twitter from a listener, Edwin, at Edwin on Twit. I mean, It is meaningless whether the Huskies are ranked number 25 or also receiving votes.
Literally just an arbitrary number that they choose to rank.
Yeah, it could be any number. But from the standpoint of like people around the country paying attention to the Huskies, it legitimately does matter, I think. Like, you know, if you go to ESPN.com, the score page, it only is going to show you scores from the top 25s. The Huskies weren't on there before. Now they're going to be on there. So hopefully they pay it off by winning both games this weekend. But
And right now in Bracketology, which I believe was updated today.
Was there an update after I looked at it?
Is today February 26, 2019?
I mean, tomorrow is February 26, wow. 2019. So, wow, you're it's 12 minutes from now. So
updated
I guess it's
from
East Coast
the
time.
Future. The Huskies, they were previously a 7 seed, still a 7 seed, have been playing against VCU in the first round, which is basically what you would expect from it's the lowest place that you would expect them to be is a top 25 team.
Yes. Which, I mean, if you were going by the S curve, the top 24 teams would be the top 6 seeds and 25 would be a 7 seed. So it's logical from that standpoint. We'll see if the selection committee is thinking along the same way. And of course, plenty to come here. Matisse Thybulle was named Pac-12 Player of the Week after recording 6 steals and 4 blocks in the Huskies 62-45 win over Utah, where they held them without a field goal for, I believe, 16 minutes approximately during that game. A really long period of time. And then he got 6 steals and 5 blocks in their 64-55 win Saturday versus Colorado, becoming, as I noted on Twitter, according to sportsreference.com, the first player since at least 2009-10 to twice in his career record at least 5 steals and 5 blocks in the same game.
Matisse is incredible.
He is. He was also chosen as a semifinalist for the Naismith Defensive Player of the Year Award and surpassed Brevin Knight for second place in Pac-12 history in career steals. He is now 20 behind Gary Payton's all-time record that he seems very likely to break.
Is he going to win the Defensive Player of the Year? Or does he not have a big enough profile to do it?
He might. It's a real possibility.
Which would presumably be the first time in Husky history that that's happened.
I certainly don't know of anyone that's won that award. Husky's still so hanging steady at number 36 in the KenPom rankings.
I mean, they'd have to win some of these games by like 50 points to increase.
I thought the Utah win would move them up a little more, but it ultimately did not. Still projected to go 16-2 in conference play. And so they need one more win to clinch the Pac-12 title outright. And if they don't get it Thursday at Cal, something has gone horribly wrong. Cal comes in 0-15 in Pac-12 play, is threatening the first winless season in conference play in the Pac-12 since Oregon State in 2007-08. They rank 281st in the KenPom rankings.
That's crazy.
They are last in Pac-12 play in both offensive and defensive rating. Opponents are making 60% of their two-point attempts, while Cal, the Bears, are shooting just 44% on their own twos. This is a game that the Huskies should win, and despite being on the road, win comfortably.
Yes.
That's probably all we need to say about it. Stanford, their second opponent this weekend.
How much does KenPom have them winning that game by, out of curiosity?
I mean, it's definitely not like 100% chance because, you know, the...
But like how many points?
Going on the road is difficult. I don't think it's that as many as you think it is. 14.
Huh. They should win that game by more than 14 points.
I'd be fine with anything in the double digits. It's fine. Stanford is
fall 2 spots.
7-8, but a little lucky to be that close to 500, having been outscored by 2.2 points per 100 possessions. So far during conference play, they are 11th out of 12 teams in offensive rating, ahead of only Cal, and 7th in defensive rating. They are last in the Pac-12 play in both three-point attempts and three-point percentage at 31%, which seems to bode poorly facing the zone.
This one still makes me a little bit nervous. My, like, history as a Husky fan, knowing them going into these games that they should win against kind of weaker opponents, this is one where it's like, we'll probably win that. I mean, Cal is so bad that one doesn't make me nervous. But my alert is high for the Stanford game.
I mean, it's the kind of game the Huskies have lost a lot in the past, but the kind of game also that they've won this season, you know, on the road against a decent team. You look at, I mean, better teams. They beating Oregon and Oregon State both on the road. The Colorado and Utah sweep on the road, I think, is relatively similar. One thing I think to watch in this game, Stanford star is KZ Okpala, a likely first-round pick in the NBA the next season in June. Their best three-point shooter at 37% ahead of Dejon Davis, the Garfield product and backcourt mate of Jalen Noel, was at 35%. He had 22 points on 9 of 17 shooting at UW. Largely, I think after that game was in hand for the Huskies, but I think in this one, I would expect to see, you know, they started out playing Okpala on the perimeter against the zone, and he's not going to have much of an impact there. They want to put him at the high post in the middle of that zone, operating and making plays, making shots and making passes from there. And so I think they'll probably start out with him in that spot.
No team has really, aside from that one Arizona State game, been able to really effectively do that. I'd be curious to see if this is the game.
I don't know if this is going to be the game, but I think Okpala can be effective there.
Do you think this is the... There are four games left in Pac-12 play. Cal is almost a certain victory, right?
Yes.
Is this the hardest remaining Pac-12 game?
I think the answer statistically is yes, because of the importance of home court advantage. Oregon State and Oregon are both better than Stanford, but because of the fact that you're on the road, it's their lowest probability of victory. Which, let's see, did I put in here their chances of winning out? I multiplied that out at one point. It's about 30% their chances of winning out.
So if they were at the 16-2 that Ken Pom has them at, this is the loss that they would most likely have.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, obviously the 16-2 reflects the possibility of them losing any of the last three games. Stanford notably allows the lowest rate of three-point attempts in the country. The Huskies attempted just 14 in the first meeting, making 6 of them, but had a huge shot volume edge by forcing 18 turnovers in that game.
So, Howard, and you talk about three-point shooting. Three-point shooting is basically random, right?
Maybe not so random against the zone, but yes.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
I'm coming around on it.
You have come around. But the thing that isn't random is three-point attempts.
Yes.
And so Stanford's limiting three-point attempts. They're doing what you should be doing. How are they doing that?
I mean, I think they play a pretty conservative defense. They're conceding a lot of other stuff to get that benefit of not giving up. They force very few turnovers. They're not very good on the defensive glass. You know, they are pretty good at defending the two overall. But I think, you know, they're playing an ultra-conservative defense, probably pretty similar to the Blazers. Your beloved Blazers play under Terry Stotts, where they also are very good at preventing three-point attempts and attempts at the rim, but that's a trade-off of not forcing turnovers.
Let's not compare one of the top four seeds in the Western Conference to Stanford.
Okay, they don't have... Damian Lillard is not walking through that door. No one has said it's Dejon time.
All right. It's Dejon time.
I like Dejon Davis. I'm just saying he's not Damian Lillard. So this is a tricky game, but still a game the Huskies should win.
Oh, man. Oh, if they could win this game.
It would be great, because they would be raked for another week.
If they could win, if they win out, let's just say, hypothetically speaking, are they a lock for the NCAA tournament going into the Pac-12 tournament?
Yes.
If they lose one game, are they a lock for the NCAA tournament heading into the Pac-12 tournament?
I don't think they're a lock, but they're very likely in. I mean, they're going to have delivered a better conference season than the 2012 team, and they definitely had a better non-conference performance than the 2012 team. I mean, they're just a better team all around. I know we're scarred by 2012.
We are.
We're really scarred by 2012.
On the ESPN Bubble Watch, they were currently at the should-be-in phase. They were not quite to the lock.
Yeah, and I mean, look, if they lose their last four games in their Pac-12 tournament opener, like, yeah, I'd be very concerned at that point about their chances of getting in, especially because they had lost at Cal at that point. But that's why there's still work to be done. You can't just shut it down now. But if things go as they should, I think they will probably not necessarily need a win in the Pac-12 tournament.
All right. That's where I want to be.
Exactly.
I want to be able to lose the first game that they play in the Pac-12 tournament. Just not that they're going to, but just have that in your back pocket.
Yeah.
Just try to get in. For the love of God.
Have that safety net.
We need this.
Yeah. It's been a long time. Not quite 10 years, but a long time.
I mean, not Mariners long, but
no.
It's been too long.
No. Nothing is Mariners long. All right. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.